You know, this is Valentine's weekend, and I hope that isn't a newsflash to you if you're married. If you are, you're in trouble. But I'll never forget many years ago, actually, when we were in our late 20s, I had a Valentine's weekend that taught me some lessons that I've never forgot. We were living in North Vancouver at the time, and Sylvia and I were asked to take care of three teenage girls, and the parents were going away. They said, "Will you take care of our girls for a few days?" And it was through Valentine's weekend. And I said, "Absolutely." My first lesson came about when I was sitting at the breakfast table with my wife and the oldest teenage girl named Jen. And we were having breakfast, and there was an all-out fight going on upstairs between Heidi and Steph. I mean, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're fighting. It was horrible. And I said, "I got to go see what's going on." And both my wife and Jen said, "Don't go up there." But I thought, "I got to do something." So I went up there, and they were in one of their bedrooms, and the door was closed. So I bang on the door, and I go, "What on earth is going on, girls?" And Heidi says this. She says, "Steph has my bra, and she won't give it back." Lesson number one was listen to your wife. I should have never have gone upstairs. Here's lesson number two. It was Valentine's. I was working a day shift with the ambulance service. We just cleared Lionsgate Hospital in North Van, and it struck me. It's Valentine's Day tomorrow. I got to get my wife something. I said to my partner, I said, "Terry, drive down Lonsdale. We got to find a store. I got to get my wife something." And we came to one of those curio shops, so you know, they have all kinds of things. And I went in and I bought her what I thought was a cute, innovative gift. And I gave it to her. And she didn't think it was cute and innovative. Here was what it is right there. It claps when you play music. I thought it was cool. She didn't. The monkey went back. I was in trouble. Here's the second lesson I learned. Sometimes no gift is better than any gift. Yes, the lessons we learn as we go through life. Well, we're going through a series on marriage, and we started a couple weeks ago. And if you were here, you know, we looked at three paradigm shifts. And then last week, we looked at five you musts. We looked last week that you must check your expectations, and you must view your spouse correctly. You must rejoice in your spouse. You must follow the example of Jesus and serve your spouse, and you must be willing to suffer if you want to have a joy-filled, healthy marriage that reflects Jesus well. And in 2 weeks, because next week is my wife's birthday, and I promised her months ago I'd take her birthday weekend off, and we were going to go to Seattle until the dollar went yeet, so we're not doing that, but we'll do something. But in 2 weeks, we're going to look at a really, really important truth out of Scripture about marriage. We're going to look at God's design on March 1st. And here's the deal. I was explaining this to someone this week. When we understand what God's design is for marriage, and we apply that to our marriages get blessed. You know why? Because we're wired up to live the way God wants us to live. And when we live into His design for things, we get blessed. And if you want a healthy, joy-filled marriage, 2 weeks, we're going to be talking about God's design for marriage. Now, today I want to do something. We've been looking at right thinking, right believing, right attitudes lead to right actions. That's what we've been looking at. 2 weeks when we go to God's design, we're going to go back to that. Today, though, because it's Valentine's weekend, I want us to look at the whole concept of love, and I want us to look at how we're doing in acting out our love in our marriages. Or if you're single, I'd like you to look at this. How are you living your life in relation to this? So this applies to both marrieds and singles. I'm tilting it to marrieds. But if you're single, just take what I say and apply it to your life in general, not your marriage in specific. It says this in Ephesians 5:1. "Be imitators of God, therefore, as dearly loved children, and live a life of love. Just as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifices to God." Because, Paul says, you are God's dearly loved children, you should imitate God by living a life of love. Because you are God's son, because you're God's daughter, because you are redeemed, because you're adopted, because you're a saint, you should live a life of love. And what better place to start living a life of love than in your marriage? Now, the English language, as I've shared with you a couple of years ago, only has one word for love, and it's love. But the Greek language, in which the New Testament was originally written, has several words for love. I'm going to look at three of them briefly this morning with you before we get into 1 Corinthians. The first word for love in the Greek language I want to look at is the word eros. And eros, which is the word that we get the word erotic from. So when we talk about eros love, we are talking about loving another person in a romantic or a sexual way. And obviously, this is an important type of love in any marriage relationship. Yet it's important to note that eros type love does not stand up well under pressure. That romantic sexual kind of love does not stand up well under pressure. And with hurtful words, with hurtful actions, with stress in marriage, eros love can wither and die. And when a couple comes to me or a spouse comes to me and talks to me and says, you know, our sexual life is just died out. The problem isn't the sexual life. The problem is something's caused the sexual life to die out. Something has caused that eros love to wither. Eros love is an amazing love. It's an important love in marriage, but it's a love that can wither under the stress of marriage. Here's the second word, philia. Philia describes a type of love that binds two friends together. Philia is the word for friendship love. It's a term of endearment, of affection. The city of Philadelphia gets its name from two Greek words, philia and delphia, which means brother. Hence, the city of brotherly love, Philadelphia. Philia is the love between two friends. Let me ask you, think about your marriage for a minute. In your marriage, are you friends as well as lovers? Friendship is a huge part of marriage, and it's so easy to lose that. You need to work at making sure your spouse is your friend. That's so important. And can I just say something? You know, I'm getting older, got a few years under my belt. Can I talk to the younger couples here for a minute? Here's one of the things I see young couples. I see a lot of young couples today who are totally child-centric. Your family revolves around your children. You're child-centric. That's not healthy. That's not the way God designed a family to be. Children are important. You're to love your children. But when it comes to the family, you need to be centered around your spouse first and then your children. And I see too often in young families today, the child is the number one, not the spouse. That is problematic. That is problematic for your marriage, and that is problematic for your children. Your children need to see a strong, healthy marriage. They don't need to know they're number one. They need to know that mom or dad are number one to each other. That's what they need to see. So can I encourage you, young couples, do something that us old people used to do. Get a babysitter and go out on date nights on a regular basis. That is so important. That is so important. Your children will survive. And I'm not trying to be talk down to you. I'm trying to encourage you because I see this. And what I see happening in the years down the road, here's what's going to happen with some of you. You're going to wake up one day, your children are off to university. You're going to look at your spouse and say, I don't know you. I don't even like you. I'm out of here. That's not good. You need to build your marriage, and you need to build your marriage on eros love. You need to build your marriage on a philia love, on a friendship. Take date nights regularly. And I'll just tell you what we did when our kids were small. It was really helpful to us. And what we did when our kids were small is we bought season tickets to things. For years, we went up to Shemanis Dinner Theater. So that ensured that 7 or 8 times a year, we had a date night together where it was just us and we were going out. And then we got tired of that, so we bought symphony tickets, and we did that for a while. Then we bought theater tickets and did that for a while. But we always made sure that we had something that was set in the calendar, so we had regular date nights, so we could keep our friendship alive. Now we're empty nesters. Every Friday night is date night. That's not always practical to do when you have little kids, but you need to regularly date. Make sure you're doing that. Make sure that you have the friendship, love in your marriage. It's so important. And so I want you to take these report cards. Here you go. This is where you get to work. Remember, action oriented. What you're going to end up with this morning is a snapshot of what you think about yourself as a spouse. So here's a key important thing for this. You're rating yourself. You are not rating your spouse, all right? I just want to be clear. I am not causing marital conflict, all right? You are rating yourself this morning. And here's what I want you to do, and just do it intuitively. Don't spend hours thinking about it. You're going to miss the rest of the sermon because I'm going to give you a few seconds. But I want you to look at the top two there, eros and philia. Okay, eros and philia. I want you to grade yourself as you think you're doing in your marriage. Okay, how am I doing with the romantic, sensual love? Am I an all-star? B, C, D. Failure is D, right? How about philia, friendship? How am I doing at being a friend of my spouse, making sure I'm taking the lead and getting us out, A, B, C, or D? So grade yourself just on those two things and take 15 seconds to do it while I take a drink of water. Just go with the gut. The gut's off. It's like multiple choice in school. You know, you go with your gut, then you go back and change it, and you're wrong. Go with your gut. And if you're a single person, yeah, look at the friendship one, not the other one. Otherwise, I'll be in trouble. All right? And some of you aren't writing it down or circling it because you're afraid. I know, but... All right, there's one more word for love in the Greek language I want us to look at this morning. It's the word agape. And agape is the most common Greek word in the New Testament for love. It's also, you may not know this, one of the least frequently used words in classical Greek. The few times agape appears outside the Bible, it is used in the Greek language to express the highest and noblest form of love. When we're talking about agape love, we're talking about a love that is selfless and sacrificial and unconditional. Webster's dictionary defines agape this way: the selfless love of one person for another without sexual implications. One author defined agape love this way: a permanent self-sacrificing commitment to act in the best interest of the other person regardless of emotions or circumstances. You'll notice something here. When we talk about agape love, we're talking about a love that is not a feeling or an emotion, but rather a love that is a deep decision of the will. Love is a feeling. But listen, love is so much more than a feeling. It's not that feelings don't matter, they do. But here's the thing you need to realize: feelings can't be the foundation of a loving, dynamic marriage. Because if your love is only based on feelings, what happens when the feelings change? And they will. If you've been married more than 20 years, put up your hand. Quick. Okay. All right. Of those people that have put up their hands, you've been married more than 20 years, how many times have you ever felt your feelings for love wane from your spouse? You guys are a bunch of wimps. I just want you to know. Yes, of course you have. Otherwise, you're preaching next week. Of course you have. You know, and it happens. Because feelings come and go, but that can't be the base of your marriage. If it is, here's what happens. When feelings are the base of your marriage, you end up in my office looking at me saying, I don't love my spouse anymore. What that means is I don't have feelings for my spouse anymore. But you know, and this is how the rest of the story usually goes, but I do have feelings for someone else. Because what happened, you see, is my love was based on eros. And then eros got transferred because my marriage was based on feelings to someone else. And now I have eros feelings for this person, but not this person. And that's a problem. A love that goes the distance is a love that is a deliberate choice. It is an act of the will. It's a love that says this: I choose to act in your best interest regardless of how I feel all the time. Regardless of how you act or react, I choose to act in a loving way. You see, here's the thing that happens. This is awesome. When we act, even when we don't feel loving, you know what happens? An incredible dynamic starts to take place. Our feelings start to change, and we start to feel loving. Here's something I've said, and other counselors use lots of times. A couple comes, or a person comes and says, I just don't feel like I love my wife anymore. And I say, well, here's what you need to do. Write down 5 things you did when you felt like you were loving your wife. Okay. I said, now go do those things. Even though you don't feel like you're loving your wife, go do those things. And you know what happens? The feelings start to return. I read this week a story of a woman who went to a marriage counselor and told the counselor she wanted to divorce her husband. She said, I want to hurt him in the worst possible way. What would you suggest? So the counselor replied this. He said, start showering him with compliments. When he thinks you love him devotedly, then start the divorce action. That's the way to hurt him the most. And so she returned 2 months later to report that she'd followed his advice. Good, the counselor said. Now is the time to file for divorce. Divorce, cried the woman. Never, I've fallen in love with the guy. See, that's what happens. You can act your way into a feeling. Agape love is a self-giving, unconditional type of love. And if you don't realize it, let me tell you this morning, it's a love you committed to when you stood wherever you stood and shared your marriage vows. When you shared your marriage vows, you made a promise to fulfill your part, irrespective of the other person, regardless of your circumstances. Remember, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health. You didn't say, well, as long as you're healthy, you said in sickness, right? That's agape love we promised. Agape love is a self-giving, unconditional type of love. It's the love that's described so beautifully in 1 Corinthians 13. Let me read it to you. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking. It is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Here's what we're going to do today. We haven't got time to go through all those descriptors of love, but I'm going to pick some out. They're on your pink sheet. We're going to go through, and again, as we go through them, I want you to rate yourself, not your spouse. All right? Here we go. Love is patient. Love is kind. The word that Paul uses for kind there is a verb. So rather than saying love is kind, a better way of translating this phrase is to say love shows kindness. When I think of love showing kindness, I don't know about you, but I think of small behaviors that bless others. You know those kind of behaviors we do where people say to us, oh, that was so kind of you, thank you. That's not usually huge things, it's usually little things. Behaviors like, you know, adjusting the car seat so that when your spouse gets in, they're not all crunched up, right? Putting the dishes in the dishwasher when it's not your turn, which my wife would call a miracle if it happened in our house. Those kind of things. Let me ask you a question this morning. If you were to list your acts of kindness towards your spouse in the past 7 days, how long or how short would that list be? I want you to take your pink sheet. It says kindness, scale of 1 to 10. How kind are you to your spouse? One is kind. No. Okay. 10 is like, I'm as kind as Jesus. All right. So scale of 1 to 10. How Jesus-like are you in kindness, right? Scale of 1 to 10. Just rate yourself. Just intuitively take 10 seconds. Say kindness. In my marriage. I haven't done this yet, so I'm going to do it with you here. All right, got it. And just single guys, if you're in the room, Proverbs 19:22, great verse for you. Kindness makes a man attractive. Single guys, You want to find a wife? Be kind. Be kind. Truly, kindness makes a man attractive. All right, back to 1 Corinthians 13. I got to keep moving. It does not envy. It does not boast. It is not proud. We talked about that last week. It does not dishonor others. The flip side of dishonor is, obviously, honor. And to honor means to value and to respect and to highly esteem. And while dishonoring tears down and devalues, you can imagine that honoring builds up and respects. It treats the other as valuable. Do you remember back to when you were dating? How did you treat your spouse? Honoring or dishonoring? Honoring, because if you treated them dishonoring, they would have dumped you. They wouldn't have married you. And so when we're dating, we do all these honoring things, right? We open the doors. We buy presents. We bring flowers. We cook special meals. We say, I love you, and all that kind of thing. We show honor over and over and over again. And then we get married. And guys go, because we've got that kind of conquer thing, got it, got the marriage thing done, now on to the next thing. And we can easily move from honoring to dishonoring. And I can't tell you the number of people, and again, this is a generalization, but as I talk to women that are struggling in their marriages, one of the heart cries I hear from ladies is, I wish my husband would honor me. I wish he would build me up. I wish he'd compliment me. In marriage, we can show honor through our words. Our words, as you know, can build up or they can tear down. They can bring honor or dishonor. And I want you to think back quickly to the last week in your mind, to the words you spoke to your spouse. Were they words of honor or dishonor? Did your words build up or tear down? And in marriage, we can show honor through our actions. Same thing. Think back to this last week. Did your actions towards your spouse show honor or dishonor? If you want to have a great marriage, rather than taking your spouse for granted, which is so easy to do, rather than doing that, how about you commit to showing honor, to esteeming, to building up, to encouraging, to valuing your spouse with your words and with your actions. So take your report card again. Honoring. How honoring am I? 1, I totally dishonor my spouse. 10, I'm as honoring as Jesus. Where are you in that? How honoring are you in your words and your actions to your spouse? All right. If I can do it as quick as that, you can do it as quick as that too, I guess. Then you can always go back and revisit it. Number 10, then Paul says, love is not self-seeking. Here's the deal. When most of us, if we're really honest, when most of us got married, we were thinking of what we could get out of marriage, of what our spouse would do for us. Oh, certainly we wanted them to be happy as well, but most of our thoughts about were, what would marriage do for me? Then after the wedding, we were surprised and shocked to find out that our spouse didn't spend every waking moment focused on us. And suddenly we go, whoa, what's this about? And then people say, well, I'm no longer happy in my marriage because my needs aren't being met. You know, happiness is a unique commodity, and researchers have found out that happiness is never found by people who are trying to get it. Genuine happiness is a byproduct of making someone else happy. It is found by focusing on the other person rather than on yourself. And we talked about that last week. To have a joy-filled, healthy marriage that represents Jesus well, you need to be other-focused. So take your sheet. As you look at your marriage, how other-focused are you? 1 is, I'm a self-centered pig. All right? 10 is, I'm a servant like Jesus. Where are you on that? How other-focused are you in your marriage? Where are you? How other-focused are you? Okay, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 13. Paul says this, love is not easily angered. There is no emotion. There is no emotion that puts the brakes on marriage more abruptly than anger. Now, let's be honest. All of us have a boiling point. If pushed far enough, every one of us will blow. That was like my dad growing up. Because I had two siblings. I was the oldest. And we could get my dad going and get my dad. He was starting to get irritated. He'd turn red. And then his veins would start to go. And then you knew that he was going to blow. And the last kid in the room was going to get it. And so we were all like, boom, out of here. Because the truth is, all of us have a boiling point. And that's why Paul says love is not easily angered. In other words, a loving person can be provoked to anger, but not without significant effort. In other words, love has a long fuse. And I want to ask you a very, very important question. Because I see what this does to marriages. Here's the important question. Do you have an anger issue? Do you have an anger issue? If you do, you need to do something about it because it's destructive. Do you have an anger issue? I don't know if you know this, but acting in anger is a choice. Do you know that? When you act out your anger, you're choosing to do so. Nobody is forcing you to act out your anger. And you're saying, you're not married to my spouse. Nobody is forcing you to act out your anger. It's a choice. We have more control over our anger and acting out our anger than we want to admit. Want an example? I'll give you one. There's 350 people in this room. Many of you are married. I guarantee, and the married folks in this room, somebody had an argument this morning with their spouse. Maybe it was about coming to church, getting the kids ready for church, being on time, getting in the car, the way your husband drove here. I don't know, but you had an anger. You had an argument. Somebody's had an argument this morning. I guarantee you. And you get angry. And then you get to church. And it's like, okay, we're at church. Everybody got to look happy. Act happy. No arguing. We're at church. We look like we're perfect. And you all do. See? That proves to me you have control over your anger. Nobody here is acting out in anger right now. You do have more control over your anger than you think that you do. Anger is a choice. It's controllable. So here I want you to take this and say long fuse. When you think of your marriage, when you think of your relationship with your spouse, not with your teenage kids, with your spouse, how long is your fuse? One is, I don't have a fuse. The bomb just goes off. 10 is, I don't ever get angry. I'm perfect. Where are you on that scale? Where are you? All right, here's the next one. Paul says, and he carries on, he says, love keeps no record of wrongs. We like to keep records of wrongs, don't we? We like to store them up. Huh? Note that one down for later. We like to keep records of wrongs. You may recognize the names of the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. They're two of the most largest, most well-known bodies of water in Israel. The Sea of Galilee receives water from the north and releases it to the south. And this constant flow of water makes the Sea of Galilee very conducive to sea life. In fact, there are more aquatic inhabitants that flourish within its depths. I mean, there's just tons of them. It is alive. Then there's the Dead Sea. I don't know if you know this, but the Dead Sea only takes in water. Everything it receives, it retains. And because the Dead Sea has no outlet, only tiny, tiny fungi can survive in its ecosystem, hence its name, the Dead Sea. And you're going, wow, that's very interesting, but what on earth does that have to do with marriage? Listen, when we retain an offense, when we keep a record of a wrong, when we refuse to forgive, we become like the Dead Sea. Our closed spirit, our retaining of the hurt, it causes our marriages to become environments where no good thing can live or flourish or survive. The refusal to forgive is toxic to you, to your relationship with your spouse, and to others. And we often miss this. When I refuse to forgive, it not only rots me, it not only destroys my marriage, but it has relational impact beyond that. There's collateral damage to your kids, to your family system, beyond your immediate family, to your friends, to your work, everywhere. That's why Paul says this. Love doesn't keep a record of wrongs your spouse has done for you. That's my little addition there. But that's true. Love shouldn't keep score. Love shouldn't store up. It should let go of the wrongs that have been suffered. And you may say, but I don't feel like forgiving. You have no idea what he or she has done. Forgiveness is a choice. Because agape love is a choice. Forgiveness involves a deliberate choice. Love chooses to forgive. And forgiveness is the key that starts healing and reconciliation between you and your spouse. And I want to say today is the day for a fresh start. If you need to forgive, forgive today. Make the choice, because it is the beginning of reconciliation when I choose to forgive. And it's the beginning of the end when I choose not to. So choose forgiveness. Grab your pink sheet. Have a quick look. I got to keep moving fast here. But scale of 1 to 10. 1 is, I am a bitter, toxic person because I won't forgive. 10 is, I forgive like Jesus. Where are you on that scale? Let me also say this, that it takes more than forgiveness to build a joy-filled, healthy marriage. It takes trust. And that's why Paul says, love, trust. Understand this. Trust is an essential ingredient for a great marriage. When we trust our spouses, we believe in their integrity. We feel that what they say and do is true, and we have no reason to doubt them. But when someone violates our confidence and is not truthful in either word or action, trust is fractured. And when that happens, more then once, trust begins to dissipate, and if it continues on, trust is shattered. And sometimes we just go right to the trust is shattered part. You find out your spouse is having an affair, trust is shattered. Shattered. Is there any hope? Can trust be rebuilt? Yes. Understand the word yes. Trust can be rebuilt, but understand this. This is so important. Trust is not rebuilt overnight. I can't tell you the number of people. I'll just use a fictitious example. Say a husband has an affair and his wife finds out, all trust is shattered. Then a week later, the husband's sitting with me saying, I don't understand why my wife doesn't trust me anymore. I asked for forgiveness. Everything's good. No, it's not. Your wife actually probably wants to punch you in the face right now. It's not all good. And it's going to take a while for trust to be rebuilt. Understand that. Trust can be rebuilt, but it takes time. It starts with one spouse forgiving the other. And when that happens, a seed of trust is planted again. But because it takes time to rebuild, trust is rebuilt upon that really upon the record of integrity. And it takes time to establish a new record once trust has been shattered. And the spouse who has broken trust needs to establish a new record of trustworthiness. The person may begin to be totally honest in all his or her dealings and actions. And then what happens is every time the spouse finds the other spouse telling the truth, their confidence in them grows a little bit. And every time the spouse finds the other spouse actions matching the word, a seed of trust is planted. And slowly, a foundation of trust is rebuilt. But it takes time. But it can happen. So grab your thing. And here's the question for trusting. What is the trust level that you have in your marriage? How much do you trust your spouse? One is, I don't trust them. I got a private eye watching them right now. 10 is, I trust them implicitly. 100%, I trust them. No question. Where are you at? All right, one more here. And that's this. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. The word truth there in the Greek implies speaking the truth. Love rejoices when the truth is spoken. How much of a truth teller are you in your marriage? How much of a truth teller are you in your marriage? Are you keeping secrets? You're not a truth teller. How much of a truth teller are you? And let me just say this, because I think it's important to say today. A truth teller doesn't sweep stuff under the rug that's destroying their marriages. There are some things that are not okay in marriage. Abuse, sexual unfaithfulness, abuse of children, addiction, etc. Not okay in marriage. And it's unloving to accept such behavior as a way of life rather than speak truth. So many people in abusive relationships just accept that as the norm and never speak out against it. But listen, behaviors like the ones I just listed destroy people and relationships and marriages. And while you can't change your spouse, you can lovingly confront and speak the truth to them. And speaking the truth in love with grace is redemptive. It's redemptive. So I want you to look at that. True speaking. How much of a truth teller are you in your marriage? One is, I'm a lying thief. Ten is, I'm an open book. I just tell the truth. All right? So rate yourself there. Now I want you to take your report card. And I want you to look at your report card for a minute. And some of you are going, oh, I'm sunk. Man. And your wife's probably looking over your shoulder right now and going, you overrated yourself, buddy. But that's a discussion for home, not for here, okay? Get to the car first. All right. But here's the deal. You look at that, and I want to say this. If your scores are in the low, here's something I want you to hear as I wrap up. And otherwise, I'm going to have a huge parking lot problem again. Here, listen. Listen, this is so important. Paul says this, love always hopes. I want to end with that this morning. You know, in the early years of our marriage, Syl and I despaired. We despaired. It seemed like our dream of a great marriage would never happen. We were caught up in that whitewater I was talking about a few weeks ago. And we were just getting slammed. And we were deciding, do we swim to the side and give up? Or not? And you know what we chose to do in the middle of that, which seemed really hopeless? We hung on to a couple of things for dear life. Here's the things we held on to. We held on to the commitment we made to one another and to God. Those vows we shared, that we said we'll be there through the good times and the bad. We held on to those, and we held on to hope. We held on to hope that things could get better, that we could get out of this whitewater as we got slammed around. And we're slamming, not literally, but we're slamming each other. And we thought, can we get out of this? And here's what we found, that hope keeps love alive. And over time, we came out of that whitewater and we learned how to navigate the whitewater when we got back into it. And we now have a great marriage. But the only reason we have a great marriage today is because when we got through that whitewater and we were tempted to swim to the side, we hold on to that life preserver that was our commitment and we held on to hope. And they paid off. And I want to say to you this morning, there is hope for your marriage, no matter what you scored. No matter where you scored, there is hope for your marriage. Never, ever, ever, ever doubt what God can do in your life, in your spouse's life, and in your marriage. He is a God of restoration, reconciliation, and redemption. Never, never give up, as Winston Churchill said. And here's what I want you to do with this report card. You notice the bottom? Here's what I want you to do. I want you to look at that, and you don't have to do it. I'm going to show you a short 2-minute video. You can do it during this 2-minute video, or you can just decide to do it later. But here's what I want you to do. There's a lot of stuff there. Don't try to tackle it all at once. But say, what's one area? What's one area with God's help and empowering, I can move it from a 5 to a 7. I can move from a 6 to an 8. I can move from a 1 to a 3. What is it? What is the one area that you really feel, if you moved it up a couple of notches, would most bless your relationship and bless your spouse? Identify that one area and then identify your first or your next step in that area. So if your one area is honoring, I got to be more honoring. I want to move my honoring from a 4 to a 6. Okay, how are you going to do that? What's your next step that you can take this next week in doing that? Do those two things. God will use them to bless your marriage.